star, are you shining just for me? City of stars, there's so much that I can't see.
Yeah, all right.
Hello.
Good morning, everybody.
I felt
that, of course, is from La La Land. It's City of Stars from the movie La La Land, which we'll be talking about as we do our annual best of, worst of movies of the year. We will do a summation here of 2016 in the movies. Colin Suter, Eric Childress join me every Monday morning to review new movies, and it is our it's again our annual summation of the movies, you know, best, worst, all that stuff. We got subcategories and all that cool stuff. And let me welcome Colin and Eric to the studio. Hey guys.
Hello.
Welcome. Before we jump in to the lists, we separated the documentaries from the narratives, and we'll get to the documentary list first. I wanted your thoughts on the Golden Globes.
I didn't see the whole show. I saw Meryl Streep's speech, which was amazing.
Yeah.
And I saw about the first half hour, 45 minutes, and then I got bored and went to watch the Carrie Fisher, Debbie Reynolds documentary. Mm. So. Yeah.
Okay. All right. How about you?
Didn't miss a lot in the back half. As long as you saw the Steve Carell, Kristen Wiig bit on animated features. You see that?
You didn't see that?
I did not see that.
You got to check it out online.
See that. Okay.
Because it was the funniest thing of the night. There's no question about it. It was
that
great.
Meryl Streep and some surprises here and there. I think the Oscar race is interesting.
I think so too.
Yeah.
I think so too. On the TV side, I was thrilled Atlanta. I was just thrilled that Atlanta won.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
and Donald Glover, a best actor as well. He's just so cool, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but anyway, so yeah, I thought, you know, Jimmy Fallon was virtually non-existent,
which was a good thing.
Yeah. They you know, they did the big musical number, mm-hmm, takeoff from La La Land at the beginning,
which
and that
fine.
Was fine. Yeah, it was fine.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, he would just, you know, but that's kind of typical of the Golden Globes though. Like the host disappears for like a huge chunk of the show.
Right.
I mean, even when Gervais hosted it, he'd be gone for.
But you can kind of see that Fallon is so adept at not wanting to be controversial at all.
Oh, yeah.
That he will stay. I mean, he made a couple Trump jokes during his monologue, but even they were kind of tame. I mean,
right.
Hugh Laurie had the best Trump joke.
Yes, he did.
That Meryl Streep then reiterated
right
later on. But yeah, he's so middle of the road.
Yeah.
I mean, he makes Leno look like Letterman, I guess.
He's, you know, he really does. I mean, He does absolutely play it safe, and his show, you know, the Tonight Show, I watch it every once in a while. I don't hate Fallon, you know. I mean, I used to love him on SNL when, mm-hmm, he was on SNL. I thought he was great. The show, you know, I don't think he's a very good interviewer.
No.
You know, I don't know. So, but anyway, so it was you know, the Oscar race has heated up. I think we were discussing this beforehand, Eric, that it looks like Emma Stone is probably going to win Best Actress.
Yeah, I think that was cemented tonight.
I mean, they didn't give it to Portman.
They didn't give it to Portman, so there's no race. I mean, unless they're going to give – I mean, I think now Hooper gets nominated. I think that was a little bit wishy-washy, but I think she gets nominated now. But it seems that it's Emma Stone's to lose.
I think so, too. Yeah. And I don't mind that at all.
Sure.
Okay. We're going to do documentaries first, but let me just preface this by saying – there's this weird existence of OJ Made in America,
mm-hmm,
that it is a TV show and a movie, and you know, it's gonna win, like it might win an Oscar, gonna be nominated for Emmys, and so it's just this weird, strange thing. And I didn't include it on the documentary list. Because I wanted to talk about it separately.
Mm.
Because if I were to put it on any list, it would be number one.
Yeah.
On anything.
Yeah.
TV, movie, whatever.
Right.
It is one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen in my life. So you guys, I'm assuming you watched, you've seen it.
Yeah.
It's jaw dropping.
It's amazing in scope. I mean, it is just the, you know, I've got a problem with the issue with the whole thing of, you know, putting it into the Oscar race.
Yeah.
I'm kind of annoyed by that because I think it's taking away a lot of attention from a lot of other great documentaries that came out this year that are, you know, kind of getting pushed aside because this 7.5 hour behemoth has kind of taken over the race and is all but guaranteed to win, every documentary award, and deservedly so. It deserves it. It's an amazing achievement what it did here.
Yeah.
But I'm glad we're kind of talking about it separately so we can give attention to these other documentaries that came out this year.
Right. I mean, for anybody who has not seen O.J. Made in America, it is an incredible piece of work. I mean, in magnitude, not in scope and what it's about, and it's not just about the trial of the century. It's about a lot more than that. And it never flags. It's almost eight hours long, and it's never boring. It is constantly intriguing, and it says so much about the state of this country and what it was like in the 90s in L.A. and here, and it's about masculinity, and it's just about so much more than just, you know, documenting what happened, you know, with the murders and the trial. It's more than that, and it's a really special piece of work. So anyway, we wanted to get that out there. O.J. Made in America, we acknowledge its greatness. All right, so let's do the documentaries. Now, what we'll do is I'll give you my top 10 and talk a little bit about what I put at number one. So I'll start. Number 10 on my list of documentaries is Fire at Sea. Number 9 is Gleason. Number 8 is Wiener. Number 7 is Raiders. Number 6 is Camera Person. Number 5 is 13th. Number 4 is Tickled. Number 3 is Tower. Number 2 is De Palma. And number 1 is Life Animated. And Life Animated is, I chose number 1. It's just, it is a great film. For those people who don't know, it's a documentary about a kid who was born with autism and learned to communicate through watching Disney animated movies. And it's more than that. I mean, that's in the simplest of descriptions, that's what it is. But it's funny, and it's really, really moving, and it's beautiful, and it's incisive. It's a terrific movie, an absolutely terrific movie. So my number 1 documentary of the year is Life Animated. Okay, Colin, what are your 10?
All right, my number 10 is Tower. Number 9 is Tickled. Number 8 is I Am Not Your Negro. Number 7 is Wiener. Number 6 is De Palma. Number 5, Werner Herzog's Lo and Behold, Reveries of a Connected World. Number 4 is Fire at Sea. Number 3 is Newtown. Number 2 is Life Animated. Number 1 is Camera Person.
No, you chose Camera Person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll talk more about that when we get to our.
All right. All right. Eric?
Okay. My number 10 is De Palma. Number 9 is Nuts. Number 8 is Raiders. Number 7 is Newtown. Number 6 is Camera Person. Number 5 is Wiener. Number 4, Kate Plays Christine. Number 3 is Gleason. Number 2 is Tower. And my number 1 is Life Animated.
Okay. All right, now I didn't include documentaries on my top ten, on my best of list, so that's why I made the separate list.
Okay.
All of my best films of the year are all narratives.
Okay,
so I just wanted to make sure that, and I'm assuming you guys didn't do that.
I got a few, one documentary.
Okay, All right, so anyway, that's our doc list, and so we thought we would start out with that. A good year for documentaries, and it has been for. Wouldn't you guys say that? I mean, it's like a renaissance time for documentaries now?
We've been in a renaissance for a long time, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I really do think, like, ever since, I think, 2003, when we just had that big explosion of great documentaries. And it's been, you know, just a phenomenal run ever since then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you just look at the short list of the films that could get nominated for an Oscar. I mean, the short list has been chosen. It's hard to even choose from that list, let alone the expansive number of films that we're talking about. It's crazy. We're going to be upset. We're going to be very happy and very upset when we see the best documentary list when it comes out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a stellar year. And I'm glad you guys both included De Palma.
It's a movie lover's movie.
It is. I just found that movie to be specifically made for De Palma fans.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And like people like me who like pretty much worship everything the guy did. And I don't know how it plays for people who don't like his movies or aren't interested in Brian De Palma. I don't know how it would play.
I always tell people it's the best and the worst episode of Inside the Actor's Studio ever, because I think that it's beautiful to watch. I mean, it's just as a fan, it's great to watch. But then there are times when I think that they could have expanded upon things further.
Yeah.
I mean, I could have watched that movie for 4 hours.
Me too.
Fine with that.
Oh, yeah, me too. Me too. Yeah. All right. Well, so those are our documentaries, and here's how we do it. We've got 20 of the best films of the year. We each pick 20. We'll start at number 20 and work our way up. I'll give you my choice. Then Colin will give you his, and then Eric will give you his. So, are we ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Best movies of 2016. Number 20 on my list is Jackie, the biopic with Natalie Portman, who did not win the Golden Globe last night. And she plays Jackie Kennedy in it. And it's a very unusual biopic. It doesn't follow the standard issue sort of blueprint that you would expect from a biopic. It tells the story in a unique way, in an interesting way. It's beautifully shot, and the acting in it is great. Natalie Portman is amazing in it, and it captures the time period beautifully. It is it's a really wonderful, very original take on a biopic, and an unusual one at that. So number 20 on my list is Jackie. All right, Colin.
Number 20 on my list is Don't Breathe. This was a really just ingenious little horror movie that is quick and tight and, you know, just has the simplest idea. Three kids go to rob a house that's owned by a blind guy and his dog, and chaos ensues. And it's like one fantastic set piece after another, and it all culminates in this terrific sequence involving the dog that just... I was going crazy. I've never been more scared of a dog in a movie in my life, I don't think. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, number 20 on my list is Don't Breathe.
Yeah, that won't be the first time
hear
that.
No, I know, right?
So there's a little hint.
Dogs will kind of might come up again, too, at some point.
Okay, number 20 on Eric's list.
Number 20 on my list is Krisha, a sort of nerve-wrackingly personal holiday film about mother, a matriarch of a family who comes home and has to basically reinsert herself into a family that she's been estranged from for all this time because of drinking and personal problems that she's had. Her son hasn't quite reconnected with her, and it's told in a series, a lot of one-shots and you know a lot of background information that we're not quite privy to right at the beginning. But it's a movie that just slowly builds. It's funny, and then it gets to a point where you almost have to be laughing at how tragic this movie gets, and then it just bowls over into really tragic territory. A tough film to watch at times. I can't really say it's rewarding because it does punish you a little bit. But I think there's a really great artistry. Trey Edward Schultz, who directed the movie, clearly there's a personal angle. A lot of his own family is in the movie, and I think it's a pretty remarkable debut.
Okay. All right, we got to take a break here, guys. Hang on. Colin and Eric are here. We're doing our year-end roundup of the best and worst and everything else in between for 2016 movie-wise. We'll take a quick break here for the news, and when we come back, we'll get back into our lists right here on 720 WGN. Alrighty then. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. That is music from Rogue One, a Star Wars story. And we're talking about the year in movies. Colin Suter, Eric Childress joining me live in the studio for our yearly visit. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
And we just cracked our top 20, and everybody just said what their number 20 was on their list, and we're going to continue going for the best films of 2016. Phone number is 312-981-7200. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Is the best way to stay connected. And all right, so let's get back to it. Number 19 on my list is Other People, a little film based on the experience of a guy who used to write for Saturday Night Live, whose mother became sick with cancer, and it is. It's a really wonderful movie, and I thought Molly Shannon was spectacular in it, and I really liked it a lot, and it moved me. I found it deeply, deeply moving, And I enjoyed it so much that I like a train song now because of it. The Drops of Jupiter. I now have a really nice memory attached to that song because of the movie. I got to tell you, you know. So, but I this song's a piece of crap.
It's
but
funny it's, how but, money, movies can do that to
no,
us.
No, but it really. I mean, I just you know. It's used so beautifully in the movie. I mean, it really is beautifully used in the film. So, anyway, I just thought it was great. Really, really well done. Nicely acted by everybody involved, especially Molly Shannon. So, Other People is number 19 on my list. All right.
My number 19 is the Audience Choice Award winner at the Chicago Critics Film Festival, and that's Hunt for the Wilder People. People don't know this movie. It's one of the best comedies of the year. Taika Waititi wrote, directed it. He did What We Do in the Shadows last year. This guy has a great voice, a really great comedic sensibility. I think he has a lot in common with Edgar Wright in the way he cuts things and, you know, a lot of quick gags that, you know, blink and you miss it. And he knows how to cast just the, you know, the right people in the roles for that, you know, especially in this film, with these two characters played by Sam Neill and a kid named Julian Dennison, who has, I'm looking at it right now, the best IMDb pick I think I've ever seen. you know, they're stuck out in the middle of New Zealand. They're fugitives, kind of. They're on the run from the law. And they just meet all these quirky people who just, every one of them is just wonderfully cast, especially this this 13-year-old girl who almost steals the movie. And I'm not even going to try to say this actress's name because I know I'll butcher it. But it's really one of the, you know, like I said, one of the best comedies of the year. I had a great time watching it again tonight before I came over here. And people should definitely check it out. Hunt for the Wilder People.
All right. All right. Number 19 on your list, Eric?
My number 19 is the Coen Brothers' Hail Caesar. I think a boundlessly inventive comedy that the great thing about the Coen Brothers movies throughout their entire career is that they get better the more times you view them. Sometimes you don't pick up on everything the first time. And this is one of those rare movies that I felt that I picked up on so much what they were going for the first time. And maybe that's a wink and a nod to myself. But I thought that this was a really fascinating story using Hollywood as sort of a surrogate to test the whole concept of religion through communism and using big musical numbers and big Hollywood set pieces to distract us from some of the bigger ideas that they were going for in between the lines and whether or not we were listening or God was listening to us. There are a lot of films that might come up tonight that have to deal with God and faith and things like that. And I thought this was the most clever of the films, very slyly clever film.
Okay. All right. Number 18 on my list of the best movies of 2016 is Arrival. Arrival, I think, a great piece of science fiction with really great performances. Amy Adams plays a language expert who is brought in when an alien ship some alien ships have ported themselves in on Earth, and she comes in to try and communicate with these aliens. Jeremy Renner is in it. Forrest Whitaker is very good in it as well. It's a great piece of science fiction, and it's simultaneously like really creepy and very very moving. And I know Eric hates the ending.
I didn't say a word.
I know Eric hates the ending, but I thought it was a great film, and I thought it was very, very moving and just a really, really great piece of science fiction. So Arrival is number 18 on my list. All right.
My number 18 is another film that played at our festival. It's another small one that you really have to seek out called First Girl I Loved. It's if this movie hadn't come out, maybe Edge of 17 would be in this slot because it is a movie about teenagers. This one about stars Dylan Galula from the teenage daughter from Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and she you know, is coming to terms with her first sort of romantic interest in a woman, and she has to deal with that, and her best friend, who's a guy who has a crush on her. And the movie does this really beautiful thing where it just kind of plays with time a little bit, that you're not even quite aware of it until the movie doubles back and revisits something that happens in their past, and suddenly your whole perception of everything that you saw changes. And I just thought it was a really interesting take on that, because we've seen, you know, the coming of age film where somebody realizes they're gay or whatever. We've seen that movie a few times already, but I thought this one was really unique, beautifully cast. I thought the choice of the guy who plays her best friend, I thought was an interesting choice, a very unusual kind of choice. And this movie really just really moved me very much. And it was the last film I saw at our festival. And it kind of blindsided me by how good it was. So,
okay.
First Girl I Loved. It's on iTunes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Seek it out. I second that.
And that's number 18. Number 18 on your list, Eric?
Number 18 is a film we tried to get for our film festival, but we didn't. It's actually the first of the documentaries on my list that I mentioned earlier, and that's Kate Plays Christine. Which dealt with the actress Caitlin Scheel, who is hired to do to play Christine Chubbuck, who there was another movie that, made about her called Christine with Rebecca Hall. It's a famous story of this reporter, this female reporter in the 70s, who shot herself on air on a television news show. And this movie is about her as the actress, the documentary, researching the role, trying to research the role, trying to find out as much as she can about this woman, and finding out that there's very little to find out. There's just not a lot of people that want to talk about it. There's not a lot of people, not a lot of information even at the studio where she performed this act. And it just all leads to her questioning whether or not she should even be doing a role like this. Is this something that we should be revisiting either as entertainment or as an exploration of someone who is mentally ill? And I found it just endlessly fascinating. And I really think even playing as herself, she gives one of the great performances of 2016. That's Kate Plays Christine.
Okay. All right. Number 17 on my list is Midnight Special. Jeff Nichols, crazy movie. It's like a weird road movie. It's sci-fi. It's Michael Shannon and Joel Edgerton play a couple of guys who are trying to keep this kid away from who may or may not have special powers. They're kind of on the run, and people are pursuing them. One of the many movies that Adam Driver was in this year, and one of two really terrific movies that Jeff Nichols made this year. A really good year for Jeff Nichols, who I think is like one of the best American filmmakers working today. And I thought this was a very unique movie, a great child performance, and a really understated Michael Shannon performance. Because and Edgerton's got the juicier role in this one, kind of. Michael Shannon, who appeared in Nocturnal Animals as well, which is a movie that I didn't like at all, but I liked him in it. He also played Elvis this year in a movie. He's just Michael Shannon rules, mm-hmm. and it was really interesting to see him in Midnight Special, kind of not doing the Michael Shannon thing.
Yeah,
and
you
he works
that about him in Loving too.
Yeah, absolutely. He's kind of the one scene
great.
In Loving.
Fantastic
yeah,
in that scene.
Yeah. And he and Jeff Nichols obviously work very, very well together. And I thought Midnight Special was a really terrific original movie. And Jeff Nichols is just he's a great filmmaker. So that's number 17 on my list. All right, Colin?
My number 17 is one you mentioned, Jackie. And there are, this is the time of year when we get the prestigious biopics and true story films, and there are, a number of ways that they could have made the obvious Jackie Kennedy biopic. And Pablo Larraine, the director of this film, didn't do that. And, I think what this movie accomplishes in a very tight 97 minutes, which is, again, another unheard-of thing for a true story film. We're going to tell this thing in 97 minutes.
Yeah.
And really just isolates this period of time that, we all kind of want to know more about than anything else is, you know, the period of time when, you know, JFK was assassinated, you know, before, during, and after that event. And the way the movie plays with time is, you know, I think pretty extraordinary. And, of course, it goes without saying that Natalie Portman is phenomenal in this movie.
Yeah. It's interesting that there were a couple of, like, biopics that came out this year based on true stories that were, like, 90 minutes long. That and Sully.
Yeah.
I was like, what's going on here? Right. You know, you just Clint Eastwood, Tom Hanks, Sully.
IMAX.
I would imagine it's, you know, I would have thought it would be 2.5 hours long.
It's a good trend. I like the trend.
Yeah, I do too. But of course, you know my theory as to why Sully was short.
Yes.
Because,
yes.
You know, Clint is very notoriously cheap and wants to do things. So he shot the whole thing on IMAX, which is more expensive. So he's like, it's going to make it 90 minutes. that's my theory.
Well, Sully also doesn't make the case that it needed to be longer.
No.
I feel like I got the whole story in 90 minutes.
Yeah.
You know,
but Colin, it's a story you haven't been told.
Yeah. Oh, insurance companies are corrupt? I never knew.
No.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah.
And I like that it didn't make my top 20, but I enjoyed Sully.
It's okay.
I thought Sully was good. Okay, 17 on your list, Eric.
17. Now we hit on another theme of the evening, films that made me cry. And it's another documentary, and it's Gleason. This is the story of Steve Gleason, who was a New Orleans Saints football player who at the in his early 30s was diagnosed with ALS. And the simplest way to describe this movie is that it's a real life My Life. If you remember the movie with Michael Keaton, where he played a man dying of cancer who creates this video log for his unborn child, and that's what we see. And we see him from the diagnosis of the disease to how quickly it begins to invade him and invade his mind and his speech pattern and everything. And it becomes this wonderful, sad testament to living. And the people around him and the strength, again, faith and God and things play into this movie quite a bit. It's also a remarkable story about fathers and sons, which is a theme that I'm very happy to revisit. And, I mean, seriously, there's not a moment in this movie where some crying or whatnot. It was like Fantasia Day all over again, you know, the Steve Carell thing. But yeah, I mean, I think this movie is a remarkable testament to just life, really.
Yeah, it's a terrific movie. He was at they brought him out on stage at Pearl Jam.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got such – I mean, the interview he does with Eddie Vedder alone.
Yeah.
Eddie Vedder was making me cry.
No, they brought him out on stage, and, you know, and he communicated through the keyboard, and he swore. It was really great. It was great. And he was up there while they played.
Well, they did it at Wrigley?
Yeah, at Wrigley. Yeah, they brought him out at Wrigley,
It's great.
Yeah, amazing. Okay, that was a great movie, too. All right, we got a break here, and then we'll come back, and we'll get into our top 16 movies. And it's the best, worst, and all that stuff with subcategories for the movie year of 2016. More with Eric and Colin coming up right after we take this break on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trip Tower. This is music from the film Jackie. One of the best movies of 2016, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the best movies of 2016, the worst. We got subcategories all coming up. It's our annual visit with Colin and Eric. They're live in studio with me. Welcome back, guys.
Hello. How are you?
Okay, and we are going into number 16 on our lists of the best movies of the year. Let's see. My number 16 on my list is Hell or High Water, which is a really terrific Western with great performances from everybody involved. Of course, Jeff Bridges, that just goes without saying. But it's about two brothers who go on a bank robbing crime spree in order to save their property and you know, use the stolen money to pay back for their property. There's a real undercurrent of in this movie about what it's really like to live nowadays and in the West. There's a political angle to this movie and a racial angle to the movie. There's a lot going on. And on the simplest of levels, though, it's a very exciting, very, very, very well-made movie, which I found it to be a real intense experience. And it's one of my favorites of the year. Number 16 on my list, Hell or High Water. All right. Colin?
My number 16 is Chan-wook Park's The Handmaiden. This insane movie that I can't even, you know, the story of which I can't even really start to describe. It's crazy. In multiple languages, you know, with different colored subtitles, so you know what language it's being spoken, because that is important. And, you know, it's not a movie you can just sort of casually watch. You really have to tune into this thing. Because you're constantly being thrown for a loop as to, you know, which character is shady, which character is, you know, pulling strings or whatever. And I had a great time watching this film. It's incredibly erotic, probably the most erotic film of the year. And it's one of those movies where, you know, I don't want to watch it again because don't think it's going to be quite as special as it was the first time, like knowing everything that, you know, going in. But it's definitely worth seeking out. And I was really thrilled that the Chicago Film Critics Association gave it best screenplay. I think that's a really interesting choice. And I'm glad our group did that. So,
okay. 16 on your list, Eric.
We have a match.
Uh-oh. Oh.
The Handmaiden is number 16
nice.
On my list.
All right.
Yeah, I echo everything Colin just said. And I got to this film very late, right before. It was the last film I watched before I voted, and it ended up in a number of places on my ballot, too. It's a crazy film. And Chan-wook Park's repertoire, if you will. I've liked all of his movies except his English language one, Stoker. That's the only one of his films that I don't like. But if you're a fan of this guy's work, this film is right up your alley. And, you know, it's really, you know, I have to call out Sony for putting – they're only putting out a DVD of this. They're not putting out a Blu-ray.
Oh, you're kidding.
Of this. Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. There's an uproar over it. It's a gorgeous film to watch. Even on DVD, it was a gorgeous film to watch. But if anything, it's a movie begging for a Blu-ray transfer, it's definitely this one.
Yeah, so. And we're talking about – this is a guy who directed Old Boy and right. Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance and Lady Vengeance.
Right.
That's who we're talking about.
Right. Mm-hmm. Great filmmaker.
Yeah.
Great filmmaker. Yep. Didn't make my top 20, but I liked it a lot. All right, so we're getting into the top 15 now. So number 15 on my list of best films for 2016 is The Invitation. One of the creepiest movies of the year. Beautifully directed. Why am I blanking on her name?
Kusama.
Yeah. It's her best movie since Girl Fight. And it's a simple movie. A guy gets an invitation to a dinner party that is being thrown by his ex. You realize some weird stuff is happening at this dinner party, and there's an ulterior motive for why everybody has gathered here. It's creepy. It's a movie that is really that keeps you off center throughout the entire film. Like you're on the edge of your seat the entire movie. You're not quite sure what's going on. Is the main character just nuts? Is he just, you know, picking up on something that's there or isn't there? It is really beautifully made with great acting all the way around. John Carroll Lynch, who rules in everything, is tremendous in this. It really builds in terms of suspense, huge amounts of suspense. And the final shot of this movie, is my favorite final shot of the year. Just the final image that was just, it's breathtaking. A great movie. And one of many, you'll see a pattern on my list this year of, there's a lot of suspense and horror on my list this year, which actually has usurped a lot of other. I can tell you right now what movie did not make my top 20, and you guys are going to both punch me in the mouth. Moonlight didn't make my top 20. So
I'm not a violent person.
I know that, but I just thought I'd tell you that right now. It didn't make my top 20. It was a movie that I rewatched it, and it just didn't stick with me like the first time I saw it, and it decreased as I watched it. But then movies like The Invitation, that stuck with me more. I don't know.
But
so,
it's also a film about grief, too, and I think that's another topic that's going to come up
yeah,
a couple times
yeah.
on a movie.
And not only that, but I mean, that's also been like a theme in many really effective horror movies over the past couple of years.
Yeah.
is grief. I've got another couple on here that are about that. So should we break here, Dan? Yeah, okay, we're going to take a break. You guys hang on, and we'll get to your top 15 right here. We're starting out, and we'll do a little recap when we come back in case, because we got the news coming up here. So we'll take a quick break, and Colin and Eric are here. Best movies of the year for 2016, and we will have more coming up right after this on WGN.
Go north with wings on your feet.
Welcome back, everybody.
Go north with the wind where the three rivers meet.
Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and it is our yearly visit with Colin and Eric in studio, and we are talking about the best, the worst, and everything in between for the movies of 2016. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
That from a criminally underrated and little-seen film from this past summer called Pete's Dragon. Didn't make my top 20, but it was a terrific movie and deserved a much more than it got. Nobody saw it, and that's too bad because it was terrific. So that's from Pete's Dragon, and we are counting down our best movies of the year. Let me give you my we'll recap what we've got so far. Number 20 on my list was Jackie. Number 19, Other People. 18, Arrival. 17, Midnight Special. 16, Hell or High Water, and then 15, The Invitation. Colin, what we remind everybody what your bottom five were?
Number 20 is Don't Breathe. Number 19, Hunt for the Wilder People. Number 18, First Girl I Loved. Number 17, Jackie. Number 16, The Handmaiden.
Okay, and Eric?
My number 20 was Krisha. Number 19, Hail Caesar. 18, Kate Plays Christine. 17, Gleason. And 16, The Handmaiden.
Okay, so number 15 on your list, Colin.
Well, you gave me quite an intro. My number 15 is Pete's Dragon.
Right, there you go.
We do not share these lists.
No, we
by
don't.
The way.
No.
We discover we go along. We discover
that's
what everybody's choices are.
That is a coincidence, yep. And I'm very grateful for that. That is a really wonderful song from that film, and a movie that uses music really well. And I've noticed over the years we've had a lot of. There have been a lot of indie directors who get handed big studio tentpole projects like Spider-Man and things like that, and then or Jurassic World, and then you go see the movie and there's not a trace of a director's sensibility in those films. The studios have kind of taken it out of them. They're just these cookie-cutter films. Well, this is a film directed by David Lowery, who is a guy who made a really interesting movie a few years ago called Ain't Them Body Saints with Casey Affleck. That was a really interesting, really cool movie. Definitely an indie film. But he was a guy who really put a lot of love and care in this project and brought that indie sensibility to it, which was really refreshing to see. And like you said, this was a movie that was really underrated. Not a lot of people took their kids to see it, and I think Disney dropped the ball on the release of it.
I agree.
And
I totally agree.
August was just a bad month to release great movies.
And
suffered the same fate.
Another thing I want to mention before you get back, one of the problems here is that it's called Pete's Dragon.
Yeah.
And the movie from the 70s was a piece of crap.
Oh yeah.
And so it's hard to.
To sell.
Yeah. When I heard about it, the live action version of Pete's Dragon, this is going to be terrible.
Right.
And it's just not that kind of movie. It's a beautiful film.
Yeah.
And I really think there was a lot of baggage, especially for people who are around my age, because I was like 12 when that movie came out, mm-hmm. when the original one came out, and I remember seeing it and going, what the hell is this?
Yeah. See, I'm wondering if that's really a thing, though, because funny story, at New Year's this year, one of my friends came up to me and said, we watched Pete's Dragon over it. And I told him, because of the 1977 version. He goes, what?
He wasn't even aware.
It's not one of those go-to classics that anybody actually goes to. Pete's Dragon, that's my number 15.
Okay, cool. All right, 15 on your list?
15 on my list is Mel Gibson's Hacksaw Ridge. I think
I'm a little disappointed he shaved his beard.
Are you?
He looked like a lunatic with that beard.
I know. I want him. Well, I don't want him to look like a lunatic because I think that just enforces the that aspect of him. Right. As much as it exists, I don't. You know, I'm glad that this movie actually made some money and resonated with people who went and saw it because I think it's a gloriously old fashioned World War II movie with a Mel Gibson sensibility. And it's a movie that tackles issues of faith in God in a way that sometimes he goes overboard with it a little bit, especially in the final shot. But I think that as World War II movies go, this is a story I was not aware of, and I'm always grateful when movies can tell me a story, even an extraordinary true story like this that I was not privy to. And it's apparently even it was toned down from some of the extraordinary feats that this guy actually did. The last 45 minutes of this movie, the brutality of the war sequences are the most graphic since the opening of Saving Private Ryan, for certain, maybe even surpass that. And
Mel
I think
Gibson, man.
I know. I mean, and this is what he does. But, you know, it's like they said on South Park, like, say what you will about him, but the SOB no story structure. Yeah. And I think that's exactly what's on display in this movie. I think, you know, if you're a fan of old-fashioned World War II movies, and we had a couple of those this past year, I think you're really going to – and you like Saving Private Ryan, I think you're really going to enjoy this movie.
Mm-hmm. All right. Number – number 14 on my list is a real crowd pleaser. Number 14 on my list is The Eyes of My Mother.
Yes.
I don't even know what to say about this movie except that I think it's awesome. It essentially what happens is a guy shows up at this house. Mutilates a woman, kills her. The husband comes home. A little girl witnesses this. Husband comes home, takes the intruder, chains him up, keeps him in like a shed, and basically tortures him for years. And as her father passes away, the young girl, as she grows up, continues this tradition. And that's kind of just the starting off point for this movie. Shot in black, glorious black and white. It is brutal. Okay, this movie is not for everybody. It's does not back away, does not shy away from brutality or violence. But what this movie, I found this movie, and I told you guys this before. I found this movie really moving, sort of deeply moving. and it's about trying to create family out of nothing. Or trying to create family out of torture and violence. It is not for everybody, but I was pretty much astonished by this movie, by most of it. It's hard to describe without people just thinking I'm a lunatic. But this was number 14 on my list, and it is a brutal movie. It's not for everybody, absolutely. I thought the performances, particularly the lead, she's amazing in this movie. And again, as screwed up as this movie is, and it's a pretty screwed up movie, I was really sort of emotionally moved by it. And I know that sounds very, very weird, but it hit me on an emotional level that I didn't expect. So The Eyes of My Mother, number 14 on my list.
I back your play on that one, Nick.
Okay.
All right. My number 14 is, you guys might think this is too low, but my number 14 is Manchester by the Sea. Kenneth Lonergan's third film?
Yeah.
Yes.
In 16 years? Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. This is going to get talked about more, I'm sure, during the show. It's one of the big, you know, awards films of the season, so we all know about it. But the sadness on display here is just, you know, it's pretty devastating.
You think?
Casey Affleck, there's a reason he's getting all these awards. It's very well deserved. And, we're going to hear more about it later, so I'll just
let you know. I did not know that Matt Damon was originally scheduled to direct it. Did you know that he was supposed to direct it?
No, I did not know about directing.
He was going to
star in it, I thought.
He was going to star in it, and then he was going to direct it. And and he convinced Lonergan to direct it, because Lonergan had such a horrible experience on his second film that he was like, I'm not going to make any more movies. And Matt Damon ended up not – his schedule got screwed up. That's why Affleck ended up in the movie.
Yeah,
because I guess the Martian shot longer than they extended it.
Well, they had to make it funnier.
Because it was so hilarious.
Yes.
And that was funny, by the way, last night when Matt Damon line. He's still making the Martian joke a year later.
Uh-huh.
So, but anyway, I just thought that was kind of interesting. And we'll hear that title again coming up later. All right, 14, Eric.
14 is another interesting crowd pleaser, and that's Paul Verhoeven's L. With Isabelle Huppert as a businesswoman who, because the beginning of the film is raped, and what starts off as a film that looks like it's going to be about her getting some measure of revenge on, or trying to figure out who raped her and what she will do to this person if he ever comes back or if she finds out. Then it becomes a movie about her sort of owning the idea that, or the fact that she was raped, and how she lives with it and makes it a part of her, and how she's not going to play the victim, that she's going to be stronger by this incident, and maybe even a little turned on sometimes by the prospect of it happening again. Rape is, a word that should be used more than sexual assault, and it's not something to joke about, even though this movie is at times a very dark comedy. But it is a subject worthy of discussion, particularly from a woman's point of view. And Isabelle Huppert gives one of the strongest performances of the year. Won the Golden Globe. And I can't fault her for that, even though I love Portman and Jackie. And it's a really kind of a return to greatness for Paul Verhoeven. It's a hard film to watch sometimes. It's a film that you might not even understand all the way the first time you watch it, but give it a chance. It's a tough film, but it's a rewarding film if you can measure to have the discussion afterwards.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on. We got to take a break here, and when we come back, we'll continue with our best movies of 2016, and we've got our subcategories, which are coming up, and we'll probably just do that as a special podcast. And we got the worst, and that's all coming up as well. So stay tuned for more movie talk right here on WGN. Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. That is music from Kubo and the Two Strings. We're talking about the best movies of 2016. And Colin Suter and Eric Childress joined me live in the studio. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
And we were on number 14, so now we're on number 13, correct?
Yes. Yep.
All right. We're continuing our best of list. Number 13 on my list is Everybody Wants Some. Richard Linklater's spiritual sequel of sorts to Dazed and Confused, or at least in spirit. This one takes place in the early 80s in college, and as opposed to like the last night of high school where Dazed took place. So everything that was wonderful about Dazed and Confused is wonderful about this movie. It is it's very relaxed. it just kind of lingers into the theater, and you just kind of watch it and spend a bunch of time with these guys. And it's also a really good baseball movie. So I just wanted to mention that it's a good baseball movie.
It is.
And I thought the cast was really great, and it had that wonderful spirit that made Dazed and Confused so great. I've watched it a few times now, and it gets better with each viewing. I don't think it's as good as Dazed and Confused. I don't think it'll go down historically the way that Dazed and Confused has gone down. But I think for the same reasons that Dazed and Confused was terrific, this movie's terrific. And Linklater just makes good movies, man. Richard Linklater makes good movies. He's made a couple of stinkers, but for the most part, man, the majority of the movies that Richard Linklater has made are really good, and this is one of them. I think it's a terrific movie. So. Everybody Wants Some, number 13.
My number 13 is also made by a director who makes some really good movies, and that's Martin Scorsese, and it's Silence, the spiritual sequel to The Last Temptation of Christ, if you will. I think this movie is just remarkable, and I think this is Scorsese. I think that the title is appropriate because Scorsese himself is being silent during the film. It's his most restrained, stylistically, since maybe King of Comedy or Age of Innocence, maybe. But it's definitely his least mainstream movie in a long, long time. And it's, you know, it's 2.5 hours, or it's over 2.5 hours. There's very little score in it. And it's, you know, it goes back to all those big questions about faith and religion and, you know, how strong the faith is and, you know, can it be broken? And I think this is a great film to watch after Last Temptation of Christ. And I sort of sandwich it between Last Temptation and Mean Streets, if you really want to like see like an interesting, you know, progression of faith from
Mean Streets is all about faith,
right?
Yeah,
yeah. But yeah. But you know, this, I think this fits right in the middle of those two films. I think there's like there's sort of an accidental trilogy here in a way. And I think this is a really lovely, beautiful movie, and another great performance from Andrew Garfield, who really, I mean, just did a tremendous job this year with this and
films about faith in Japanese,
right? Yeah, I know, right? Between this and Hacksaw Ridge, I thought he had a great year, but he's not getting much traction for it in the awards department, unfortunately. But
just a little.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, so my 13 is Silence.
Yeah. I wish I liked it more. I gotta say, I it's a difficult movie, man.
It is a difficult
movie. And I'll see it again.
Yeah.
But I wanted to love it so much, and I just it just kind of fell short for me. It's a real challenging movie, though.
Yeah.
I mean, and deeply personal, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just wanted to like.
Yeah, it's not a movie you sit down with a bag of popcorn.
No,
and,
it's
you
not.
Know, it's no. You really have to.
This
kinda...
is a challenge, man. Well, it's a challenging movie. It really is.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Eric.
My number 13 is a little more uplifting film. It's called Don't Think Twice. Mike Birbiglia's film about an improv troupe that he's a part of, and about Gillian Jacobs and Keegan-Michael Key. And it's about this improv troupe that becomes under basically a crisis when one of their own is tapped to do essentially a Saturday Night Live show. And what happens when that person is removed from the troupe, and sort of the jealousy and the what might have been as far as these people that have been doing you know, improv for the pure love of it. For all their lives, for the better part of their adult lives, it's you know, there's been a really weird trend over the last year, I would say, where characters in narrative movies have been given spots in improv troupes as like character traits. Even 19 Other People has some really bad improv in it too. We were making fun of it at Sundance actually, and this is a movie that is in love with improv. This is a movie that's in love with that scene, that world, these characters, and doesn't mince words either. It has some really harsh truths about the people that do this for the love of it and whether or not they deserve to go any further than they actually are. It's a really funny movie. It's a movie that really cements Gillian Jacobs as someone I will watch in anything.
With Love. I mean, well, what an amazing
year. Is
that
coming back? Or is that what a one-off? It is coming back.
Yeah,
okay, I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, Love and Don't Think Twice. Gillian Jacobs had a top-notch year as far as I'm concerned. And this movie is great. It's a kind of a little hidden gem. It was one of my favorite movies from South by Southwest last year. And I think it's just coming to Netflix. And it's on DVD and Blu-ray now. So people should absolutely check that one out.
Okay. That's not the first time we're going to hear that one. Number 12 on my list is Loving, Jeff Nichols' second film in the top 20. This one telling the true story of a couple played by Joel Edgerton and Ruth Negga, based on a true story where they were arrested for being married. And it was an interracial marriage. And it's about that time period. It's a wonderfully understated movie in every way, shape, and form, and it's just anchored by two remarkable performances, two of the best performances of the year, Joel Edgerton and Ruth Negga. It's an important movie now more than ever, in this current climate that we're in, and it is it's enlightening, it's beautifully acted, it's moving. And it's a movie about love, and it just so happens that their actual last name was Loving, and it's a great film, and Jeff Nichols continues to just do top notch work, and from top to bottom, it's just great. It's a courtroom drama. It's a love story. More than anything else, it's a love story, and it's heartbreaking at times, and again anchored by two of the best performances of the year. So number 12 on my list is Loving. Okay,
we have a match.
Oh,
my number 12 is also Loving.
All right,
and you pretty much did all the heavy lifting for me on that one. But you mentioned it's a courtroom drama. It's important to know that, like, yeah, it's a courtroom drama, but it is not filled with any sort of like platitudes or big self-important speeches.
It avoids all of that.
It avoids all the cliches of this kind of true story film that we've come to expect. And you know, this is the way it should be done. And yeah, it's a beautiful story. It's one that I didn't know that much about, and I'm really glad it was, you know, Jeff Nichols who told this story. I think it's really remarkable.
Yeah, he's great. Okay, we got a break here. When we come back, Eric, you'll tell us what your number 12 is. We're talking about the best movies of 2016, and we'll get to the worst and subcategories and all that and more with our annual visit from Colin and Eric, and we're taking a look at the movies of 2016. We'll come up after we take a break here on 720 WGN.
I wish I could be the perfect daughter, but I
can't. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And it is our annual look at the movies. This is the movies of 2016. That was from Moana. I don't think on any of our lists.
No. It's a good song, though.
It is a good song. A lot of people love the movie, though. And it did very well, doing very well at the box office. And so we're talking about the best movies of 2016. And we left off with Eric, Colin and Eric. Welcome back, guys, by the way.
Hello.
And number 12 on your list of best movies, Eric?
Before I get to my number 12, I just want two quick things. One, I just want to say how much fun it always is to do this with you guys.
Oh, thanks.
This is just so much fun just to talk movies and hang out with you guys. It's just amazing. Two, if I took the documentaries off this list, my Loving would have been my 20.
So I
just wanted to say that.
Okay.
Two, number 12 is not a documentary, but it is my favorite quote-unquote horror film with a very scary dog in it, and that's Green Room. Jeremy Sonnet's unbelievably great thriller about a little punk band that gets hired to do a gig at a white supremacist hangout. And wind up witnessing some shenanigans in the green room and are basically forced to stay in there while the people on the outside can figure out what to do with what's going on in there and also what to do with them. And it's this fantastic original cat and mouse game that goes on that you're actually sitting there wondering what you're going to do if you were in that room yourself. And it's incredibly violent at times. Anton Yelchin, one of his final performances. I think he's got a film at Sundance this year, actually. Imogen Poots and Patrick Stewart as the head Nazi in charge. There's twists and turns and just remarkable set pieces. Again, astounding violence, big scary dogs, great cathartic revenge moments, it's a beautiful moment involving the dog very late in the movie that is just so unexpected and beautiful. And then there's the final line in the movie is amazing. So many great things about this movie. I love this movie.
Yeah.
Green Room.
Yeah. All right. That's not the last that you've heard about that one. All right, number 11 on my list is A Monster Calls. Beautiful film. Wonderfully well directed. Why am I? J.A. Boyega?
Boyana. Yeah.
Who is just a great filmmaker. If you've ever seen The Orphanage, he also was one of the creative forces behind Penny Dreadful and directed several episodes of that show, which I loved. This is a really, really moving film. It's basically about a kid whose mom is sick, played by Felicity Jones, who had a good year.
Not bad.
He draws this character, and it's like sort of a tree monster, and he comes to life, voiced by Liam Neeson. Helps this kid through the struggles that he has every day. And there are a lot of life lessons. It's really this is a movie that makes you cry, like hard. It is visually beautiful. At the heart of what this movie is about, it's just incredibly moving. Great performance by the kid too, and everything about this movie is really, really pretty special. So number 11 on my list is Monster Calls.
My number 11, well, you played an intro for an animated film, and this is also an animated film, and it hasn't opened in Chicago yet. It's called The Red Turtle. It's a Studio Ghibli product, and it's the directorial debut of a guy named Michael Dudok DeWitt, and he was basically Miyazaki discovered him and basically hired him to do a feature for Studio Ghibli. And he just kind of came up with this idea sort of on the fly just so he could have an idea. Because you don't turn down a job with Studio Ghibli even if you don't have an idea for a feature film.
That's right.
So he just like, well, I'm going to try this. And what he did, I mean, it's a remarkable movie. And I hope people go see it when it comes out. It'll probably just stay at the art houses, I'm guessing. It's an 80-minute film. There's no dialogue in it. And it starts out kind of like Castaway. It's a guy who gets washed up on an island. We don't know what time this is. The movie doesn't take place in any particular time, but he gets washed up on this island and he tries to build a raft to get off the island, and the rafts keep falling apart, and partly because of this red turtle that keeps bumping into it. And I'd rather not get into what happens after that. I think one of the pleasures of discovering this movie was discovering the story as it went along. I mean, the trailer will probably give away a lot, but this is like a really beautiful piece of minimalist animation. It's 2D animation. You know, like I said, no dialogue, beautiful score, a story that seems like it's really steeped in like folklore and folk tales, like the kind of story it's been handed down generations, and very strange, but really a beautiful film that is worth discovering and seeking out. The Red Turtle. Okay. It'll open in Chicago. Do we know
February 10th? I think.
Okay, February.
February.
Okay,
it's great.
So we got about a month. All right. Number 11 for you, Eric.
My number 11 is also an animated film, mostly, but it's also a documentary, and that's Tower. Story of the Texas sniper shooting on the college campus that really kind of defined as sort of like one of the big first mass shootings, something that now, well, we've seen like three in the past week. These are commonplace things. But this story takes us further than any other film that we've seen to date. And it does so through animation, which sounds like something that might be a little off base to deal with a tragedy like this, but it actually helps us understand the geography of where people are. It's told through eyewitness accounts, people who were there on the day, people who witnessed people die on the day, and shows you exactly where this guy was, where the bullets were going, where they hit, the people that were around each individual bullets, everything. It's a police procedural on top of a reenactment and a witness recount, and it takes a turn about halfway, two-thirds of the way through, that kind of hits you like an emotional thunderbolt when the movie makes this transition. And it does so without giving a lot of credence to the actual shooter, which was something that I thought was really great too. It's a remarkable documentary told through animation. It's not a tough film to watch. It's a very easy film to watch, just tough, off the subject matter. I think a magnificent piece of art.
Okay. All right, let's recap real quick before we get into our top 10 movies. I'll go from 20 to 15, 20 to 11. So number 20 on my list is Jackie, 19 Other People, 18 Arrival, 17 Midnight Special, 16 Hell or High Water, 15 The Invitation, 14 The Eyes of My Mother, 13 Everybody Wants Some, 12 Loving, and 11 Monster Calls. Colin, what were your bottom 10?
Number 20, Don't Breathe. Number 19, Hunt for the Wilder People. Number 18, First Girl I Loved. Number 17, Jackie. Number 16, The Handmaiden. Number 15, Pete's Dragon. Number 14, Manchester by the Sea. Number 13, Silence. Number 12, Loving. And number 11, The Red Turtle.
Okay.
Okay, and my number 20 was Krisha. 19, Hail Caesar. 18, Kate Plays Christine. 17, Gleason. 16, The Handmaiden. 15, Hacksaw Ridge. 14, L. 13, Don't Think Twice. 12, Green Room. And 11, Tower.
Okay. All right, here we go. Top 10 best movies of 2016. Number 10 on my list is The Edge of 17, with just a wonderful performance by Hailee Steinfeld. One of the best, I think, one of the best movies ever made about being a teenager, and one of the more accurate and honest in every way possible. Well, I just think a star-making performance by her. Just amazing. Woody Harrelson plays her teacher, and it's essentially what happens is she has grown up in the shadow of her older brother. She's very, very awkward, and had no friends except for a girl that they met when they were very young. They became lifelong friends, and then her best friend, at a time when she's feeling really low about everything, begins dating this brother. And it's about that conflict. Kira Sedgwick plays the single mom, who her dad passes away in the film, Hailee Steinfeld, and then she has to deal with all of this. Her teacher is played by Woody Harrelson, who becomes more of a mentor, and the scenes between the two of them are great. This is a beautifully written movie. It's honest, it's really funny, and I can't say enough about this performance. She's great in it, and I like this movie more every time I see it. Why am I blanking on the dude's name who played
the boyfriend?
Yeah,
Hayden Zetto.
He's phenomenal in this movie. It is a great performance. In fact, all the performances are top notch in this film. The guy who plays her older brother,
Blake Jenner, from Everybody Wants.
Yeah, he's so good in this, and he's got a speech late in the film that takes place in the doorway at Woody Harrelson's house. That is just phenomenal and honest and real. And you're rooting for both of these people. Mm-hmm. I love this movie. I unapologetically love it. So number 10 on my list is The Edge of 17. All right, we got a break, and then we'll get you guys will start your top 10. We'll take a break here. We got some weather, we got some traffic, and then afterwards we'll jump right back into the list of the best films of 2016 right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. My dad is going to call in and tell a joke because it is Monday morning. But we're wrapping up the movies for the year. Colin and Eric are here live in studio. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
That was from Sing Street. I'm sure we're going to hear that title coming up here from these two guys.
How sure are you, Nick?
I'm very sure.
Okay.
I just gave my number 10 in the top 10 best movies of the year, and my number 10 was The Edge of 17. So let's go to Colin. What is your number 10?
My number 10 is another film that hasn't opened in Chicago yet, and that's Tony Erdmann. I remember watching the screener for this thing, sort of thinking, okay, it's 2.5, it's a little over 2.5 hours. Let's just get this out of the way. And I was just completely delighted with it from beginning to end, especially at the end. I know a lot of people have a problem with the length. I don't, because I really like the characters. I did not think that the funniest thing I'd seen all year would come from a 2.5 hour Romanian film, but that is essentially what happened. And I sat in my apartment during a scene in this film. I won't say where, I won't say when it happens, but I had tears in my eyes for a good 10-15 minutes watching this scene, and even afterwards, that the movie I watched after it, I couldn't really concentrate on because I kept thinking back and just laughing. And that was The Eyes of My Mother, by the way. which is why I still owe that movie a review.
Now it all makes sense.
Now it all makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just like, I couldn't, I just was too busy. I was still laughing. I just like, I'm not into this movie. I got to watch it some other time. I got to watch something else. I love the characters. It's about a guy, an older guy who gets in touch with his estranged daughter who lives in this corporate world. And this guy just likes to mess with people. He likes to wear funny wigs. He sort of ingratiates himself in this world that she works in, this corporate world, by wearing this ridiculous looking Tommy Wiseau wig and these buck teeth. And I don't know, just something about that look that just never failed to get a laugh from me. There's something about a pair of false teeth that just in the case of this film just killed me every time. So I highly recommend it. I think it's coming to the Music Box in a week or two, and it's Tony Erdmann. Don't let the length put you off. This is a really terrific and really funny movie.
Okay. All right, Eric, number 10.
My number 10 is the funniest film that I saw last year, and a film that we've also been talking a lot about, movies that introduce faith into the plotting. And this is Sausage Party, which is a film that when you hear a movie that Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg made a movie about talking food and basically about a hot dog that really wants to get with a bun, you're not expecting a deep theological discussion within the context of the film. And first off, the movie is incredibly funny from beginning to end. Voice work from all the Rogen crew and regulars are absolutely hilarious. And then it gets into the discussion of, you know, is there a great beyond, as the opening title song will ask. Is there something once you leave the supermarket? Is there... and you know, once you find out the truth of that, whether it's your truth or somebody else's truth, how do you then try to convince people who are steeped in that belief? Are you supposed to insult them, or are you supposed to find some sort of common ground that you can come to? I don't mean to use play on words there at all, but this movie ends with the funniest sequence I saw all of last year. And I watched again, and you know, some of the shock value of it obviously lost a little bit, but I really got into the discussion again. And you know, I mean, Colin likes silence. I like Sausage Party, so maybe that says something about the two of us.
I like Sausage Party.
I know, but I think this is a deeper film than Silence. I said it. Sausage Party, I think, is a deeper film than Silence, and made my top 10 list. This is my number 10.
Okay. All right, my number 9 has been mentioned already, and it's Don't Think Twice, the terrific Mike Birbiglia film. And everything you mentioned about it, Eric, is true. The thing about this movie is that it gets it right. Having done a lot of theater and a lot of improv in my years, it is absolutely perfect in that regard. And the guy that Birbiglia plays in the movie, I love the fact that he played that guy, because that guy exists. The guy who is perpetual, you know, in the improv group. He's the guy who's been there for the longest. He's the teacher who likes to sleep with his students. It is a funny movie. It is an honest movie. A lot of it was improvised, developed through improvisation, with a great cast. You mentioned Gillian Jacobs and Keegan-Michael Key. Everybody in this movie is just great. Kate Micucci is hilarious in it. And it's funny and it's truthful. And I don't know. It is one of the movies year's movies that got everything right. It's just, if you've ever been a part of that world, it is 100% accurate, and everybody is great in it. So Don't Think Twice, number 9 on my list.
My number 9 is Kelly Reichardt's Certain Women. And I sort of run hot and cold with this director. The you know, bare minimalist thing is something that I admire, but it's hard to warm up to sometimes. But I thought this one was, I think it's her best film. It's three stories, and a lot of people refer to these stories as, you know, kind of feminist tales. And I guess, you know, they are. But to me, they're all stories about this, you know, Native Americans. Even though in the first two stories, the characters are all white. But I think the parable here is, you know, has a lot to do with, you know, the story of, you know, how the Native Americans had their land taken from them. They made, you know, had some bad deals. And but the last story with Kristen Stewart and I'm blanking on her name. Lily Gladstone is definitely also part of that story. And it's also pretty heartbreaking. And I thought this was a film that really, this one of all of her films, this one, you know, spoke to me the most. And I thought, you know, seemed to be the most, had the most to say. And the cast, it's a great ensemble that she got together for, you know, for this film. And, you know, like I said, these are low key, very minimalist films that, you know, this filmmaker makes. So, know that going in, but this is definitely a film worth seeking out. Certain Women.
Okay. All right, Eric.
My number nine is my pick for the best animated film of the year, and that's Kubo and the Two Strings, a film that, you know, a lot of really great family films or films geared to children that tackled thorny subject matter, but do it in a very unique, very original, very beautiful way. And Kubo and the Two Strings is a film about, you know, death and losing parentage. And and it's also, you know, a fable and a parable with some fantastic voice work by Charlize Theron and Matthew McConaughey. Matthew McConaughey is one of the funniest moments of the year, as far as I'm concerned, when a twist is revealed, and his reaction to it is absolutely priceless. The animation in this film is stunning. To think, you know, in a weird twist at the end of the movie, during the end credits, they actually have like a time lapse thing, and they show you how some, which I thought was a little weird and self-indulgent, actually, but it actually kind of is kind of a reminder of just how much work and effort goes into making a movie like this. An action sequence on a boat in the high seas is just extraordinary. It's a funny movie. It's an exciting movie, and a film that ultimately deals with loss and memory, and so some really important subject matter that, again, a movie in August released last year that a lot of people, not enough people went to see. And it's great. You know, Zootopia is great, and obviously I love the Red Turtle and that, but this is my choice for the best film, animated film of the year.
Okay. All right. Hang on, guys. We got to take a break here for the news. And when we come back, we will continue with the best movies of the year. We have the worst, and we have some subcategories that we always do every year, and we'll get to that as well. But right now, we got a break here for the news on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. And it's from Manchester by the Sea, a very happy movie. Colin Suter and Eric Childress are here live in studio. And every year we like to break apart the movies of the year, talk about the best, talk about the worst, talk about everything in between. And we are now in the middle of our best lists. And I think we should maybe do a quick recap just to remind people. Number 20 on my list is Jackie, 19 Other People, 18 Arrival, 17 Midnight Special, 16 Hell or High Water, 15 The Invitation, 14 The Eyes of My Mother, 13 Everybody Wants Some, 12 Loving, 11 Monster Calls, 10 The Edge of 17, and 9 Don't Think Twice. All right, Colin?
Number 20, Don't Breathe. Number 19, Hunt for the Wilder People. Number 18, First Girl I Loved. Number 17, Jackie. Number 16, The Handmaiden. Number 15, Pete's Dragon. Number 14, Manchester by the Sea. Number 13, Silence. Number 12, Loving. Number 11, The Red Turtle. Number 10, Tony Erdman. Number 9, Certain Women.
And Eric?
Number 20, Krisha. 19, Hail Caesar. 18, Kate Plays Christine. 17, Gleason. 16, The Handmaiden. 15, Hacksaw Ridge. 14, L. 13, Don't Think Twice. 12, Green Room. 11, Tower. 10, Sausage Party. And 9, Kubo and the Two Strings.
All right. So let's start with number 8. Number eight on my list is The Neon Demon, a movie that I absolutely love. It's certifiable. It's insane. Nicholas Winding Refn directed this movie, and it is Elle Fanning plays this 16-year-old model who is thrown into this world of modeling. Jenna Malone plays a makeup artist who she works in a morgue, and there's stuff happens there, and then there are these competing models, these two models that are competing with Elle Fanning for work. It's an insane movie. It's certifiably insane. It is one of the most accurate movies about narcissism that I've ever seen, directed by an unbelievable narcissist who I know, Aaron, Colin, it drove you nuts that he actually puts his initials on the bottom of the screen.
Yeah. Over the opening credits, just, lest we forget who directed
crazy.
The film.
And it's one of my favorite score. One of my favorite scores of the year. Cliff Martinez's score is amazing. It's beautifully photographed. It's just nuts. It's a crazy movie, and I love it. And Keanu Reeves rules in it. Elle Fanning is great. It's got the creepy. There's one scene in this movie. I mean, I love the whole film. It's crazy. And then for some reason, it ends with a Sia video. I have no idea. At that point in the movie, I'm like, I don't know what the hell now. I have no idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. But there is a scene in this movie that really creeps me out. And it involves Jenna Malone in a tub and, like, just watching these other two women take a shower, washing blood off of themselves. And that scene, I have no idea why it freaks me out so much. It's just Jenna Malone in this bathtub covered in gunk and blood, just staring at these two women, and it just goes on. The scene just goes on, and it's a real mesmerizing scene, and I think a very mesmerizing movie. So this is going to be the only time you hear it tonight. But it's one of I loved it, man. I loved it. It's certifiably insane, and I love The Neon Demon. So that was number eight. All right.
My number eight is a film that has been mentioned already, and that's The Monster Calls. And this is, you know, I know, you know, my favorite animated film of the year is coming up, and it's not going to be a big surprise. But this is sort of my unofficial second favorite animated film of the year, because there are animated sequences in this film that are stunning.
Yep.
And it's a part of the film that I never get tired of. I could watch a whole movie just of this, of these sort of like beautiful watercolor animation sequences. They're just amazing. I think the kid in it is really terrific, and I think the lessons learned, I think there's so much value in this film for young people. I really do hope parents take their kids to see it. It's kind of a strange movie to try and sell to your kid, but it's at the same time, I think there are lessons in it that should be learned, and I think the way they're conveyed in this film are really beautiful. And it's another, there's a reoccurring theme this year of the role that stories play in our lives, the need for stories, the need for parables and metaphors, the need for arts, music and writing. It's a reoccurring theme this year for a lot of movies, this one especially. And I think this is just one of this award season's, you know, best film, not the year's best films, obviously, but this award season, it's a really strong film that, unfortunately, I don't think it's going to get getting a lot of traction, which is really too bad. So people should, you know, go see it anyway, because I think it definitely deserves to be seen on a big screen. So,
okay. All right. Next.
Well, this is certainly the night of the wonderful segue, because my number eight film is Life Animated. as you mentioned earlier, is our choice for the number one documentary of the year, Nick and myself. Mm-hmm. And this is a story of this journalist whose young son develops autism. wasn't born with it initially, but develops it. So it becomes a case of, you know, how do we handle this situation, and how do we now communicate with our son? And find out that he begins communicating with them through the use of Disney films and through the use of films they had watched together and lines of dialogue and situations that they're able to communicate with. And as Colin sort of just talked about, I mean, this is a movie about how movies and art can affect the way we live and the way we live our lives. And it's a remarkable portrait of autism and how this boy grows into a man and how he's going to live with autism on his own without the help of his family per se. But continuing to use Disney films to reinforce the struggles that he's had in his own life, which includes bullying. He writes a kind of a comic book about it. And this movie I cried like four times in the first 20 minutes of this movie. This movie absolutely destroyed me. And it's another film that also uses animation in a very beautiful, original way to bring these images to life from his own comic book and his life, and the way he tells the story. This is a beautiful film. It just played on A&E this past weekend, and it's available on DVD. I really hope people will seek out this movie because it's an absolute tearjerker, crowd pleaser, all of that stuff, and you'll learn a lot through it as well. Life Animated.
Yeah, I loved it. It's a great film. Any movie where I cry at the at Gilbert Gottfried,
I'm really quick. The greatest cameo. I mean, I cry. Yes, I did too. I sat there back in the music box at our film festival.
Yeah.
We played this at our film festival, and I'm sitting in the back of the theater, like crying because Gilbert Gottfried.
Gilbert Gottfried just showed up.
Yeah,
it's a great movie. All right, number 7 on my list was mentioned already, and that's Green Room. It kicks ass. everything Eric said, I just echo it. It's a throwback to the old, like, Walter Hill movies of the 70s. The bit with the dog at the end is stunning. There is also a shotgun blast at one point that I was just like, what the hell? I just love this movie. Everything that you described, right on the money. So Green Room, number 7 on my list, is just that movie rules. Okay.
My number 7, I'm not going to talk too much about it because I know it's coming up, and you guys are going to think it's too low, but my number 7 is La La Land. And I just want to say that I got the screener, you know, a month or so ago, like you guys did. I've watched it 4 times. I have a projector at home. I watch it blown up on my wall, and it's great. But yesterday, I actually went and saw it in the theater. And that's when I felt like I really saw it. You know, it's like, I don't think you know, for our colleagues out there who, you know, just, oh, I got the screener. I don't have to go to the theater and see it. No, you really should go to the theater.
And it's coming out in IMAX.
Okay, yeah. So there you go. this is a movie designed to be watched in a movie theater on a big screen in CinemaScope. And like it says at the beginning. And, and just go and see it on a big screen while you can.
Yeah.
So
okay, we got a break here. And then we'll come back, and Eric will continue, and I will continue, and Colin will continue. Best movies of 2016, that's what we're doing right now. We'll get to the worst, and we'll have some subcategories, which I think we're going to do with a podcast. We'll do that. You'll have to listen to a special podcast for that. But right now we got a break. We got weather. We got traffic. I got the weather for you right here. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And it's our special year-end look at the movies. Colin Suter, Eric Childress, and I are here. And we're talking about our favorite movies of 2016. And we were up to number 7 for Eric, correct?
Yes. All right. My number 7 is Barry Jenkins' Moonlight, which I will not punch you in the face for not having in your top 20, Nick. But I this is a movie that I liked the first time I saw it. It grew on me even more the second time I saw it, particularly because of the third act of this movie. It's a movie that's shifted into 3 very important moments in a young man's life, a young gay black man's life, very crucial moments that define him not only as a human being but as a gay man, but also as what it means to be defined as a man. It's a movie about masculinity, but also the second time watching it, it's a movie about the little comforts in life, little things that get us through the harsh realities of our everyday existence, whether it be food or a glass of water or the sound of the ocean, just these little things that are strewn throughout the film and become reoccurring themes throughout the film is something that elevated this movie beyond the what I thought was a remarkably acted piece, a film, a story about masculinity and sexuality, and done in a way that I think a lot of movies are trying to do, and I think this movie has a really great spin on it. The performances are terrific. Naomi Harris, Mahershala Ali, and Trevante Rose in the final section I think is absolutely extraordinary. A lot of people ranking this higher. But I'm ranking it number 7, and I do think it's that good.
Okay. Number 6 on my list of best movies of the year has been mentioned already, and it's Don't Breathe. This is such an incredibly well-made movie. Really simple. And, of course, Jane Levy rules, as always. Stephen Lang, though, I mean, come on, man. Come on. You know, simple premise, as you mentioned before, Colin. And, and the dog in the car, please. And I think it's a remarkably well-made movie, really tight. And it is one purpose, and it's to keep you in suspense. And it does so beautifully. And now, you know, I have logical problems with the plot. You know, but I don't care because it's so beautifully executed and so well acted, mm-hmm. and you know exactly where you are, and the director does a remarkable job knowing the place and time, and that adds to the suspense, you know, infinitely. So, Don't Breathe, number 6 on my list.
My number 6 is a documentary called Camera Person, and what this is, I think we reviewed it on the show, but it's a woman named Kristen Johnson, who's a camera person on a bunch of documentaries over the past few decades, and she collected all of her raw footage and assembled it into this film that is kind of her diary of her, a diary of her life. She also throws in some home movies of her and her kids and everything, but you really get a sense of a life fully lived by watching this film of this person that you don't see. She's just behind the camera, but she goes everywhere. And the movie, you know, kind of comes and goes from these places. You know, she was a camera person in a courtroom at one point, and we come back later to that. And so there's all these kind of little threads going on throughout the film. And it's just beautifully done, and a really personal film, the likes of which I've never really seen before. And that's why this is my favorite documentary of the year. So my number 6 is Camera Person.
Okay. All right, Eric.
My number 6 is a movie that's been mentioned twice, and that's Monster Calls. Jay Bayona's unbelievably moving family film. That's a movie that, while I think we all agree people are not seeing it now, but I think this is a movie that's going to linger as a classic amongst those who find it, because the people who show this movie to their children, or even as adults who have to deal with loss in their lives or potential lingering loss in their lives, are really going to find something really quite fantastic to hold on. This movie confronts the harshest of truths when dealing with a subject like a situation like that. And it does so in the confines of a family film with parables and stories, Felicity Jones, Sigourney Weaver plays the grandmother in the film. There's no describing how I was during the last 45 minutes of this movie. I cried my eyes out of Toronto when I saw it just a couple days ago. I cried my eyes out again watching this thing. Yeah, I can't recommend this movie highly enough. I hope that people will discover this film. And you mentioned The Orphanage. He also did The Impossible, and he is doing the next Jurassic Park film. So at least he's doing a movie that people will eventually see, and he'll get to continue making maybe these other movies that he's been making, because I think he has an absolute Spielbergian sensibility that cannot be denied, and that speaks to me as well. Mm. So.
Okay. My number five best films of 2016 is The Witch. Best horror movie of the year. Beautifully acted. Really, really creepy. Beautifully shot. And it's got a really cool goat in it.
Cool goat?
Yeah, Black Phillip Rules.
Wow, that's a cool goat.
Kind of a jerk.
Yeah, well,
goat,
you know,
kind of a jerk.
Yeah, he's the devil. So yeah, I really thought this was a great film. Very, very quiet. It was not what I think a lot of people expected. You know, and the fact that it got a wide that I saw this movie. In a theater next to a Buffalo Wild Wings was very weird. You know, like I was like, and the audience that I saw it with the first time were like, what the hell? Not at all what anybody expected. It's more of an art film than like a flat out horror movie. And I think a lot of people were expecting, you know, slash and burn and all kinds of stuff. And it's not. There's a lot of acting going on and a lot of darkness and weirdness. And I love the ending. it's a great movie. I think it's the best horror movie of the year, and I love The Witch. So that's number five.
My number five is one that Eric mentioned a while ago, and that's Krisha. This is a movie that is hard to watch, but also kind of fascinating from a filmmaking perspective. This is Trey Edward Schultz is the name of the director here, and this is a film that just kind of screams to be noticed as a strong directorial debut, and it is. I first saw it as a short film a few years ago, and I didn't think it worked as a short film. And I saw it as a feature. I thought, okay, now it works. Now it's great. And it's just about this, like Eric said, it's this kind of crazy family dynamic that's going on here. The director of this film is clearly working out some things, and it's a fascinating journey. A really, you know, strong directorial choices here with the camera and some fine acting, too, from this very unknown cast that is basically his family members who are all just really doing pretty, you know, great work in this film. So, yeah, my number five is Krisha.
Okay. Eric?
My number five is Pete's Dragon.
Nice.
Film that there's no bigger surprise of 2016 than when I sat during Pete's Dragon, walked out of Pete's Dragon. I was in some sort of weird euphoria that I couldn't believe what I had just witnessed. A movie that proves that directorial instincts can craft a project beyond what you think it's going to be. And this is a movie that is a big, you know, a big budget Disney family film laced with the sensibility of an independent director, David Lowery, who uses silence beautifully. He uses montage beautifully, which I'm going to mention later on the podcast. It's made me cry. It made me laugh. It was exciting. I left this movie in such great spirits, and I just wanted to tell the world about it. And I think this movie belongs in the great pantheon of those live-action family movies like E.T. and Black Stallion. I think it's that level of quality.
All right. Okay, we got a break here. Hang on, guys. And then we got our top four movies to talk about, 2016. We also have the worst as well. And then we're going to do a special podcast only that you can listen to with all of the subcategories that we were that we're going to be talking about. And that's all coming up right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. I just keep waiting to hear a fart at some point. from Swiss Army Man, one of the more unique films of 2016. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and Colin Suter, Eric Childress joined me live. Every year we do this, and we're wrapping up the year of 2016 with our favorite movies, and we're at number four. Okay, number four on my list is Manchester by the Sea. It's so good. It's so good, and it's so damn sad. The performances are so amazing. And Kenneth Lonergan wrote and directed it, and it's a beautiful portrait of a guy, a lone guy who's got to go back to his hometown to take care of his brother's son. And he also has to confront his past, what happened in this town, And his ex-wife, played by Michelle Williams, is involved. Casey Affleck is amazing in it. And, you know, the discovery of what happened in this guy's past is so when you actually see what happened, it's devastating. And Casey Affleck just won the Golden Globe for Best Actor, deservedly so. It's a great film, a great film. And I don't be put off because everybody talks about how sad it is. Including Casey Affleck when he hosted Saturday Night Live, talking about how crushing it is. And it is. It is a gut kick. This movie is a gut kick, but it's a good one, and it's beautifully acted, and it tells a really good story. And ultimately, it's uplifting. You know, at the end of the day, it's uplifting. There is a scene between late in the film between Michelle Williams and Casey Affleck. If you don't lose it during that scene, you don't have a heart. I'm sorry, but that's just the case. I love this movie. It's great. Manchester by the Sea. All right, number four for you, Colin.
My number four is Moonlight, and you know, there's a lot to be said about this film. Eric said a lot about it, and it was one of those films that when I walked in, I had no idea what it was going to be, and it kept surprising me at every turn what the film ended up being and the level of intimacy that is in this film. And I just think it's an extraordinary journey. It's kind of it's sort of boyhood like in a way, where we watch him go from, you know, boy to man, and beautifully cast too. I mean, that's another key to it, is the three actors who are playing this single character are just phenomenal. And it's beautifully directed. The score is great. And I watched it a second time, and I thought it was just as strong for me the second time. So.
Okay. All right.
My number four is Manchester by the Sea.
Oh, look at that. We have a match.
We have another match, ladies and gentlemen. And, it's a fun game to play to describe this movie to people and not use the word depressing.
I know.
But it comes up. People ask you about it. I heard it's depressing. Well, it is, but it's also really funny.
Yeah.
I mean, we can't stress that enough, that in the sea of sadness that this movie is steeped in, there is a lot of really funny stuff, and it's funny stuff that, along with the sadness, comes from real truth. And everyday situations, along with confronting the past, is also a story about moving and uplifting and sacrifice and what level of sacrifice you're going to do to appease people in your family and not be selfish and all these kind of things. It's a lot of movie filled with a lot of little moments, just little moments that tug at your heart, along with the big grandiose scenes that you mentioned. Michelle Williams is in this movie for 11 minutes. She's in this movie for 11 minutes.
Yeah.
And that scene that you talk about, which I wish they don't give away a little bit in the trailers. You know, I wish people would just be able to discover that scene. But when you see that scene play out, and it's not just Michelle Williams, it's Casey Affleck's reaction to it. You want to see two actors listening to each other. This is a staple, that sequence right there. And all the performances are great. Lucas Hedges also needs to be mentioned.
Yeah. Kyle Chandler, too, is great.
Kyle Chandler, yeah. I got a couple minor quibbles with the movie, but not enough to knock it any further down the number four on my list.
All right. Number three on my list has been mentioned before, and it's Kubo and the Two Strings, easily the best animated film of the year. Just a beautiful piece of work. This studio is like, it's jaw-dropping what they do. It's a beautiful movie on every level. It tells a beautiful story. It's funny. You mentioned the voice work here. Charlize Theron is, particularly just remarkable in it. It's original. Again, it's about storytelling, and just the technical aspect of this movie is just it's breathtaking. It's just breathtaking, and not a lot of people saw it, and they should. And it's just beautiful. It's Kubo and the Two Strings, number three on my list.
My number three is Sing Street, and this is just one of those great movies that is just a big celebration of life. And, this is a film that kind of burns a fire in you. You know, you kind of wanted to go out and take on the world after watching this film. You know, it just has that, it just fills you with that feeling. You know, I love Edge of 17. I love La La Land. But this is my favorite musical of the year. It's my favorite movie about being a teenager of the year. So my number three is Sing Street.
Okay.
The segues continue. My number three is La La Land, which might be too low for at least somebody in the room.
I had it at seven.
Yeah, so I was like, higher than Collins, Nick. I'm higher than Colin. But yeah, no, there's so much joy in this movie, and it's wonderfully put together. And Gosling and Stone, their chemistry is undeniable. The songs, the original songs are fantastic. The choreography is wonderful. You know, I hear these little nitpick complaints like, "Well, they're not great dancers." I'm like, "Shut up!" Like, it's not about being. They're not Fred Astaire, okay? And you know,
Ginger Rogers,
and yeah. Debbie Reynolds, and all these people. You know, it's not them. This is a wonderful throwback. It's a movie about dreams and losing dreams and gaining dreams. It's as the song says, this one's for the dreamers, and you know, we're gonna hear a bit more about this soon enough.
You think?
I think we might, and I will echo all of your sentiments when they come up.
Okay. Number two on my list is Patterson. Jim Jarmusch is. I think it's a damn near masterpiece. I'm a big fan of Jim Jarmusch. I think Adam Driver is amazing in this movie. It's about a bus driver who lives in Paterson, New Jersey. He is a poet, and it's about the creation of poetry. It is about a great relationship with his wife. It just keeps getting weirder and weirder. Like every scene with her just keeps getting stranger and stranger, and with the curtains and the dresses and all that stuff. This is just here's the deal. If you like Jim Jarmusch, you're going to like this movie. And I love it. I was really knocked out by it. I really was on every level. So Patterson is my second favorite movie of the year.
My number two is Kubo and the Two Strings. You know, you said it. The studio just is just cranking out one knockout after another. And I for one, love the sequence at the end where they show you how they do everything. You know, I think, you know, they've done it the last... I don't know if they do it at the end of Coraline, but they did it at the end of Paranorman and Box Trolls and this. And I think it's wonderful because, I mean, this is really just – these are guys who are just dedicated to an old-fashioned way of doing things, and they're doing it in a way that is remarkable. And you don't think about it when you're watching the film, but the texture of everything, the humor in this film, the voice work, it's all just magical, and it's just a stunning piece of work.
Yes, it is. Okay, number two, Eric.
My number two is Jackie. The biggest surprise that I saw at the Toronto Film Festival, this movie came out of nowhere. You see a 90-minute biopic about Jackie Kennedy on the docket, and you think, what the hell is this going to be? And as someone who's been a student of that particular piece of history, this is a remarkable way to tell the story, a film that is about legacy as well as how to grieve in a situation like that, how to be a statesman, how to be a mother, how to be someone that can take charge and be a leader through all this. Again, another film that has sequences of talking about faith and God and how to get through these situations. The scenes between Natalie Portman and John Hurt are some of my favorite in the film. Seeing this movie again a second time just crystallized everything that I loved about it the first time. I can't recommend this movie highly enough. I think Portman is extraordinary. I like Peter Sarsgaard, even though he's not really doing the Bobby Kennedy voice in the movie at all, really. He just kind of dips in, but don't let that be a distraction from you because he's good in the movie too. Yeah, just there are so many things to talk about this movie that we don't even have time for. But please check this movie out because even though she lost the Globe tonight, it really is one of the great performances of last year, and I think one of the year's best movies.
Okay, all right. Well, here's a shocker. Here's our number one movies here. My number one movie of the year is La La Land. I love every single frame of this movie. Right out of the gate, the first 5 minutes of this movie, I knew I was just going to lose my mind. And you're right, Colin, it should be seen on the big screen. It's a big difference. I've watched it many, many times at home, but on the big screen, it's a big difference. And it's coming out in IMAX in 2 weeks, and they're going to release it in IMAX theaters. And that's going to be fun. You know, what else can be said about this movie? It's just original. It's wonderful. The chemistry between the two leads is ridiculous. The music is great. The songs are great. The numbers are awesome. It is a film, like you said, about dreamers, and it's got a very bittersweet final 15 minutes that works gloriously, in my opinion. Everybody in it is great, and I love every frame of La La Land. It's my favorite movie of the year. So,
well, my number one is thank God I don't have to share a ride home with Eric anymore when doing this, because my number one is Arrival. That would have been a long walk or long ride home.
Oh, Colin.
What can I say? This movie spoke to me on many levels. It's a great science fiction film. It's a great movie about language and time as a nonlinear construct. And it is, I think, just it's kind of creepy at times. Amy Adams' performance, I think, is remarkable.
I agree.
Really understated. Yeah. I don't think she's getting enough attention for it. And, as a kind of a Carl Sagan geek, they like that also gets to me in a way. And there's a lot of things I can say about Arrival, but again, we don't have time. But anyway, Eric?
Okay, what's your number
one? Come back, Eric. Come back.
Yeah.
Sit down.
I'm still here. My number one is also a musical. It just happens to be Sing Street. This is a movie, when I saw it at Sundance last year, everyone said, boy, that movie was made just for Eric, wasn't it? A movie that seemingly was like a trip down memory lane. And all year I've been trying to justify that this wasn't going to be my number one film just because it had a lot of personal connections to it. The film works. John Carney's film, it's so beautiful. It's so funny. It's a movie that takes you. It's set in the mid '80s, and it takes you through this personal journey through music. And like his other movies, it's about the creation of an album, so to speak. But it's in the soundtrack of this kid's life. And again, it's another movie that shares a lot with La La Land. It's a movie about a kid who dreams. It's a movie that has a musical sequence that turns out to be maybe not what we've actually witnessed. There's a lot of comparisons between the two. And ultimately, when I figured La La Land was my number three, then this had to be my number one. And again, we don't have time to talk about all the personal connections of this movie. I mean, just the mere fact that they even mentioned Back to the Future twice in this movie, for God's sakes, tells you a little bit right there. But talk about a criminally underseen, undermarketed film. I know it doesn't have a lot of big stars in it and whatnot, but this is a movie that, the more people discover it, the more people realize that sometimes we do recommend some things that they've never heard of before. And this is my favorite film of the year, and I make absolutely no apologies for it.
All right. And it's on Netflix.
It yes. is on Netflix, yes.
Yes.
You can see it on Netflix. All right. Well, there you go. That's our. Those are our lists. All right. Now we go from one end of the spectrum to the other. I have 15 movies that are on the worst list, and I'll fly through the titles and see if we remember any of these. Mm-hmm. Number 15, The Forest. Huh. 14, The Boss. 13, Zoolander 2. 12, Inferno. 11, Office Christmas Party. 10, The Boy. 9, Suicide Squad. 8, The Do-Over. Did you guys see that? The Netflix
the
movie with
thing.
Sandler?
No.
Oh, my God. 7, Mother's Day. 6, Cabin Fever. Why?
Oh, God. Yeah.
5, 50 Shades of Black. 4, Dirty Grandma, Grandpa.
Don't sequelize it yet.
3, Yoga Hosers.
Oh, God.
Oh, God. Are we counting that?
Yeah. It's a piece of crap, and
yeah.
I saw it.
Oh, I need to redo my list.
Number 2, Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. And number 1, Rob Zombie's 31.
Oh, dude.
Yeah. Yeah, I skipped a lot of garbage this
year. Yeah, I know. So did I. So did
yeah.
I.
So here's mine. 15, The Hollers. 14, Captain Fantastic. 13, Assassin's Creed. 12, Ben-Hur. 11, Mother's Day. 10, The Perfect Match. 9, The Wildlife. 8, Hands of Stone. 7, The Boss. 6, Mr. Right. 7, Suicide Squad. I'm sorry, 5, Suicide Squad. 4, Independence Day Resurgence. 3, The Brothers Grimby. Grimsby. Number two, Norm of the North. And number one, Hardcore Henry.
I knew it was going to be Hardcore Henry. I knew it. All right, Eric.
Number 15, Bad Moms. 14, Hands of Stone. 13, The Choice. 12, Warcraft. 11,
oh, God.
Yeah, Warcraft. 11, The Girl on the Train. 10, Captain Fantastic. 9, Central Intelligence. 8, Suicide Squad. 7, Moonwalkers. 6, Knight of Cups. Sorry, guys. 5, Ride Along 2. 4, London Has Fallen. 3, Now You See Me 2. 2, Independence Day Resurgence. And number 1, Collateral Beauty.
I knew it. Yep, I knew yeah. it. All right. Well, there you go. So that's the list. That's our, the worst list and the best list. Now, we're going to do a special podcast. So it's a podcast only. You'll have to listen to the podcast, download the podcast, which we'll put up. And that's going to be our special subcategories. We'll talk about some of our favorite subcategories. And Eric, Colin, thank you guys so much for coming down.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next week with new movie reviews.
Yeah.
And for those people who are going to listen to the podcast, please download it. And we'll be talking about our subcategories. So we got to stop here for weather and traffic. And I got the weather right here. And guys, thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
All
right.